Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today David Margolek. Hello, David.
Hi, Vic.
David's new book is Dreadful, The Short Life and Gay Times of John Horn Burns. I had never heard of him before I read your book, but if I'd been around 50 or 60 years ago, I would have probably known who he was.
I think that's right. In fact, it's surprising how few people have heard of him and how famous he once was. It just shows how fleeting fame can be.
So why did you decide to write about him?
Well, I had a personal connection with him, Vic. When I got to the private school in Connecticut, where I went for high school, a fellow student pulled me aside and whispered to me that someone named John Horn Burns had once written a scandalous novel about this school, and that the book that he had written, the novel that he had written, was still banned from the school library. And it turned out that Burns had taught at the school. It was the Loomis School in Windsor, Connecticut. He had taught there before and after World War II, and then written this novel about the place. And I just got very curious about him. And I've been thinking about him for more than 40 years. And in the course of that time, I started to gather material on him, and I discovered that he was a very interesting guy and that he was interesting far beyond people who went to this particular school, that he was an important novelist from World War II. His background was very interesting. He was a gay novelist before there really were gay novelists. His book had sort of burst on the scene and been praised by Ernest Hemingway and Edmund Wilson and all kinds of contemporary writers and critics. And then within a few years, he just sort of disappeared and died, and it was really quite a dramatic story. And so from that one conversation in the school, this book eventually grew.
And from reading the book, it seems that he really reached his apogee due to being part of World War II. This somehow got it all going and fermenting for him.
I think that's right. He was an incredibly bright and talented guy. He had gone to Andover and Harvard before the war. He was fluent in several languages, which was why he was in Army intelligence during the war. He was very gifted musically. He was an interesting gay guy in the sense that he was both closeted in the way that people had to be back then and yet was surprisingly affirmative about it. He had written several novels, seven or eight novels before the war, very cynical and narcissistic things that were never published. But as you say, in the war sort of showed him another side of humanity and I think was a kind of wake-up call for him and brought out a kind of compassion in him that he had never really displayed before. He had been a wickedly clever and cynical and self-centered guy before the war, but particularly his time in Italy changed him. He was fluent in Italian. He loved the Italian people and Italian culture. And what he saw the war do to Italy humanized him in a way that he had never been before. And this became the basis of his great novel called The Gallery, which came out in 1947 and is largely, in various ways, a reconstruction of his Italian wartime experience.
And precisely, Naples.
Naples. Naples, the gallery refers to the Galleria Umberto, which is the arcade that's in the middle of Naples near the Opera House. And he was writing about a book that's kind of modeled after the musical piece Pictures at an Exhibition, where it's a series of portraits of different characters and then promenades or walks between the portraits in which Burns the soldier sort of reminisces about his own experiences. But it's very much a Neapolitan kind of book, just as his letters home during the war, which had never been published, never appeared in book form before, are quite extraordinary, and his descriptions of Naples during the war and what the war was doing to the Neapolitans, how the American soldiers were behaving in Naples, are very, very compelling and very vivid and very different, of course, from the kind of Greatest Generation story that's developed since then. I mean, it's to take nothing away from what the American soldiers did in Europe and the Pacific during the war. My father was one of them. But Burns paints a very different picture behind the lines of what the GIs were like in Naples and how they treated the Italians. And it's a very critical view of the GIs and a very compassionate view of the Italians. And so in that sense, it's an unusual book. But what's striking is that when the book came out, there were very few people criticizing it on the basis of his negative portrait of the GIs. I mean, it's as if people knew what the war did to American soldiers, but they've kind of been, there's a kind of amnesia that's developed about that since then. It's all become very sentimentalized, and I think it's important that a book like Burns's be revisited just to see what somebody was writing about American soldiers in real time.
The book is Dreadful, The Short Life and Gay Times of John Horne Burns. David Margalek joins us on the program today. Those letters really are amazing. In fact, that's really some of his greatest writing in these letters that you've reproduced in the book. And there's a lot of code in these letters as far as terminology that he understood, that the person he was writing to understood. But someone like me, when I saw a word like your title phrase, dreadful, I had no idea what they were talking about.
Well, in fact, I'm very happy that you don't pause too long when you say the book is dreadful. I'm glad you move right on to the subtitle, because otherwise it sounds as if you're making an editorial description. And it's one of the perils of naming a book dreadful. But I thought it was particularly appropriate, because you're quite right that Burns wrote a series of letters to one of his students back at the prep school who was also gay. And I think that these letters are really the most extraordinary letters from a gay soldier to a gay friend. They may be just about the only series of letters like this in existence. You know, I'm a former New York Times reporter. I'm reluctant to say the first or the only anything, because you always hear from people saying that's not true. There was this and there was that. But I would think that it's one of the most extraordinary sets of gay correspondence ever. Burns describes life as a gay soldier in the Army at a time when gay soldiers supposedly weren't allowed in the Army and didn't exist, when in fact, you know, there were 650 to a million to a million and a half of them serving during World War II. And he's describing in the code that you mention, you know, what life was like and what they were doing on the base and how they were seeing one another and having assignations and finding gathering places and performing together and singing music together and all of this. Much of this is written in code. The word dreadful was Burns's word for gay or homosexual, as a noun and as an adjective. So Burns would write to his friend and say, you know, I went out last night with five dreadfuls from New York and we had a wonderful time, or you wouldn't believe the dreadfulness that's going on in the barracks. And then he would describe various things that were happening. And it's a very different picture of gay life in the Army than one might have expected. I mean, these guys could very easily have been court-martialed or kicked out of the service. And yet, at least according to Burns's description, which I think has to be discounted some just for the sake of exaggeration, but it seems very clear that from his correspondence that gay life was very active and really only sort of slightly sub rosa, that they weren't desperately trying to hide it from anybody. It was more conspicuous than one might have expected.
We're joined by David Margalek. The book is Dreadful, The Short Life and Gay Times of John Horne Burns. Burns, on the pages of your book, is erudite, he's brilliant, he's witty, he's clever, and yet he's not a real likable guy.
No, this is one of the problems that an author faces. I mean, you know, you have to deal with the character that you're given. And Burns, on the one hand, Burns was a mentor to gay students and really kind of a role model, an inspiration to a small handful of his students. But throughout his life, he could be very cruel and unkind and cutting. And at times, it's very hard to like him. And I think one has to step back and one can't excuse some of the cruel things that he did, but one has to step back and imagine what it was like to be a gay man in the 1930s and the 1940s, and the kind of secret life that you had to live and the kind of subterfuges you had to resort to and all of the kind of game playing that you went through. And that colored the way that he lived. But, you know, as I say, you have to take the character that you're given, and you can't sanitize him. And I wasn't interested in that. I wanted to paint him as vividly as I could. And I think that his unkindness came back to bite him, because after the great success of the gallery came the prep school book that was the first I had heard of him, a book called Lucifer with a Book. And Burns, after the gallery, as I say, was much praised in the New York Times, in the Herald Tribune, in various other papers, in Time magazine, and he became a celebrity almost overnight. And I think that, you know, it swelled his head, and I think he felt that it gave him license to resort to his former self. And so the prep school book called Lucifer with a Book is a very cruel book. I mean, Loomis, the school where he taught and where I later went, gave Burns a job. Burns was Irish Catholic, and all the leading prep schools in New England, Andover, Hotchkiss, Choate, all of the schools that anybody familiar with the New England prep school aristocracy would well know, none of them would hire an Irish Catholic. And Loomis did. The man later got his revenge by writing a novel about the place that really skewered everybody and skewered worse than anyone else, not only the headmaster who had hired him, but another gay man on the faculty. I mean, being gay did not buy you any kind of immunity in Burns's world, and he really just eviscerated another teacher at the school. It's ironic because the man later got sick and committed suicide, and many people thought, fairly or unfairly, that Burns's treatment of him was responsible for his illness. And the man was lionized at the school. A literary prize with a theater is named after him. A literary prize was named after him. And I won the literary prize the year that I graduated. And so it's one of the paradoxes of my book is that the winner of the Norris Ely Orchard Prize for English in 1970, named for Burns's nemesis, became Burns's biographer. But so be it. That's the way it turned out. I don't know how Burns would feel about that, frankly. But I think that Burns was enough of an egomaniac in a way that he'd be very pleased that a book was written about him. And he always felt that his letters were worth publishing. And I think he thought of himself as a very, very talented and interesting guy, and he was. And I think that his letters, which I hope will also one day be published, show that this is one of the extraordinary records of World War II, and a record from behind the scenes, from the perspective of a gay soldier, a record of the sort that we don't have very many of up to now, so that I think that the book fills a void and also acts as a contemporaneous corrective, as I say, to the sentimentality of Tom Brokaw and The Greatest Generation and all of that. Things were more complicated than that.
I agree with you, David. I think that he would be delighted that someone wrote a book about him. And it's clear that you are a reporter because your reportage rings true throughout the book. You're telling us his story. You're not trying to be overly sympathetic or take sides. And you just show us the rise and the decline of this author and the tremendous ego that had him running around Naples, showing his newest couple of pages to his book that ended up becoming a big bestseller. And then after that, his ego just went out of control, and he became very cruel to people, more so than he had been before. And then he had that horrible jinx of trying to somehow come up to the level of that first book. It just isn't that easy to do. And after that, that second book was so vicious. People were running away from him.
Yes, and I think that people were waiting to attack him in a way. And someone said that James Michener, one of Burns's targets, said that he had never seen another writer annihilated to the extent that Burns was. And so Burns actually ended up fleeing back to Italy. Burns had scorned the life of the expatriate and thought there was something pathetic about people who lived overseas and wrote overseas and fled their native culture. But he moved back to Italy and kept trying to write, and his work continued to decline. And I think one of the problems is, one of the sad things, is that he could not write about the world that he knew. It would have been too risky in a way to write too explicitly about gay love and the gay world, although one of the amazing things about The Gallery, the book that really put him on the map, is that it's a profoundly gay book. I mean, it's, what's interesting about it is that when straight people read it, they thought it was a war novel. When gay people read it, there were all kinds of clues in there that it was written by a gay novelist. And people were reading two entirely different books. And I have to say that between my first reading and my second reading, they were two different books, because I was much, much more sensitized to the gay dimension of the book the second time. And once you know that, it's all over the place. But the place where it's really striking is that there's an entire chapter devoted to a gay bar in Naples that's where all the GIs hang out. And Gore Vidal called this one of the most extraordinary pieces of gay writing in the 20th century. And I think it's absolutely true. There's nothing else like it. And the whole idea of devoting an entire chapter to a gay bar in a novel that came out in 1947 is really pretty remarkable. That, to me, is one of the two most remarkable chapters in the book. The other is Burns's description of a venereal disease ward. Burns got syphilis during the war from his adventures in dreadfulness in Naples and went to get treatment for syphilis. Penicillin had just been invented, essentially, and was being used on a large scale for the first time, and it consisted of getting injections every 3 hours around the clock, seven for a week, and incredibly painful injections. And Burns describes all of this very vividly in the book. One can imagine there were not many soldiers writing home to their families about their encounters with venereal disease during the war, but Burns wrote to his disciple about this, a very explicit letter, and then he writes this entire chapter about it in the book. And I think it's one more aspect of the book that really makes it stand out. I had an interesting question the other day. Someone asked me, I mentioned that Hemingway had praised The Gallery, and this is a very literate man, the literary critic Morris Dickstein said, "I'm struck that Hemingway praised the book because he was critical of so many other books about World War II, James Jones and other people who wrote books from here to eternity. Why would he have been so much nicer to Burns?" And I think the answer is that he must have sensed that Burns had a different sensibility, maybe a gay sensibility. It was not, Burns's book is not a macho kind of book at all. And maybe Hemingway was in a position to be more generous because Burns wasn't competing on his turf.
Didn't they censor some of the gay portions of From Here to Eternity?
I think they did, and now the unexpurgated version has come out.
Mm-hmm. Well, your accounts of Burns's encounters with Gore Vidal are classic, and we get the sense that Gore Vidal knew that this was a man in Burns who was in the process of obliterating himself.
Well, I think there are a couple of striking things about Gore Vidal and Burns. The first is that they were roughly contemporaries. Burns was a few years older, but that they viewed each other, they were intensely competitive, and they viewed each other as their principal rivals. They were attentive to one another's work, and they were disparaging of it. At least Burns was disparaging. Vidal had written The City and the Pillar, and there's a letter in which Burns sort of chortles about how lousy a book it is. And at the same time, Vidal was very wary of Burns and writes about him critically in his journals. I was the first to look at his journals after he died. They were closed until he died. And in the privacy of his own diary, Vidal writes that the quality of Burns's writing left him almost stricken. It depressed him because he realized that in Burns, perhaps, that was a greater writer than Vidal. And Vidal says, Vidal has one consolation, which is that he says, and he says this with respect both to Burns and to Truman Capote, the other foremost gay writer of that generation, I will outlast them both.
Hmm.
And he did, because Vidal was not self-destructive in the way that these two guys were. I mean, we haven't talked about Burns' alcoholism, but Burns was a serious drinker. And Burns was not only was a serious drinker, but was sort of in love with drinking. There's a whole paean to drinking that he wrote in one of his early unpublished novels. And drinking was, I think, a way for him to be a bad boy and for him to liberate himself from his family. And he thought to liberate his talent. He thought that, you know, one saw things from the bottom of a glass that one couldn't see elsewhere. And so he was in love with drinking, and I think that it really ate away at his talent. One has to be able to account for why the early writing, and as you say, Vic, the letters that he tosses off are just so brilliantly written. A few of the, I had to sort of ration the letters so that there wasn't too much of his writing and too little of mine in the book, because the letters are freestanding works of art. They're little gems. And it was very tempting to quote them at excessive length because they were so nicely written. And one has to account for the, you know, how did he get from there to the poor quality of the writing at the end of his life? And you have this picture of him that I try to paint in the book when he's living in exile in Florence, and he's standing at the bar of the Excelsior Hotel day in and day out, and just getting and drinking himself to death. Patricia Highsmith and a friend of hers would go in there, and as they describe things, they would go in to watch John Horne Burns drink himself to death. That's what it looked like. And sure enough, in 1953, he was only 36 years old, he died.
Yes, that was very mysterious. Not a shock, but very mysterious, the whole death scene.
Well, this is right. I mean, Vidal, who always had a way with words, said his death made sense.
Hmm.
You know, one could almost see it coming.
The book is Dreadful, and that's the title. Dreadful, The Short Life and Gay Times of John Horne Burns, written by David Margolick. And this is quite a read. I didn't know anything about this guy. I was curious. I liked the title. I liked the title, Dreadful. I wanted to know why you called it that, and that actually lured me in.
Well, I'm happy to hear that, because as I say, people thought that I was giving hostile critics, you know, a bullet to kill me with, and I'm glad that it did. I try very quickly in the book, I think even in the introduction, to explain why I named it what I did, just so that people didn't think I was being excessively self-critical. And I'm glad that it lured you in. There's a special challenge to writing about someone no one's ever heard of. It's one thing to write about Abraham Lincoln. It's another thing to write about somebody who's so obscure, it's hard to find people who remember him. I waited so long to do this book that all of the teachers I knew who would have known him well had died by the time I came around to writing about it. I was very lucky that a fellow, in fact, who lives in Ohio, a fellow named Mark Bassett, who lives outside of Cleveland, did his doctoral dissertation on Burns. He never got it published, and the reason was that the Burns family, which owned the copyright to the Burns letters, would not let them be published. And so Mark never published his book, but he saved his materials. He had spoken to a lot of people who had since died by the time I came along, and he very generously shared his material with me. There would never be a book without him, which is why I dedicated the book to him.
The family, we get the sense at the end, he was never that close to his siblings. A lot of his letters he wrote to his mother, and as far as his siblings, he just really didn't seem to care that much about them, and yet they were very protective of his legacy, weren't they?
I think they were, and I think that they were protective of him, and they were also protective of themselves. I mean, you know, in the 70s and 80s still, one didn't necessarily want to fess up that one had a gay brother. And I think that they were very concerned about that, and they were very concerned that Burns would be captured by the gay literary establishment, and he would turn into a, into a gay icon, and they you know, one of his sisters said that, you know, they were afraid that he was going to become Judy Garland, and they didn't want that to happen, and they scrutinized everybody who wanted to write about him, and they ended up discouraging them, and so for that, that's another reason why Burns fell into obscurity. There was no sort of scholarly industry around him that might normally have developed and kept his books in circulation. The gallery was re-released a few years ago by the New York Review of Books, so that's readily available. And in fact, I think there'll probably be an uptick in sales as a result of my book. But the family, you know, in protecting him, sort of they kept the lid on him in a way and almost assured his obscurity. And I was lucky enough that his brother, who's 92 years old and a very prominent lawyer in Boston, and is now the executor of Burns's estate, really at this point wanted to open everything up, and he opened up access for everything to me and spoke to me at great length. And he was wonderful to me. And I think part of his motivation was that he wanted to see his brother get his due, but I think it was also that after 60 years, he's still curious about his brother. He still resents his brother. He loves his brother. He resents him. He's baffled by him. He's mystified by him. I think he just wanted to learn a little bit more about him and saw my book as a way to sort of study his brother and revisit his brother some. And so nothing was denied me. I had access to all of his letters, which are, as I say, a pretty remarkable collection, plus the gay letters that were saved purely because of Mark Bassett, who interviewed his gay student, Burns's gay student, 30 years ago and saved his letters. Those letters would have surely ended up in a dumpster if it hadn't been for Mark. And as I say, I think that they're an extraordinary record of the experiences and impressions of a gay soldier in World War II, a time when gay soldiers officially, at least, didn't exist.
Well, we really appreciate your time on the program today.
Well, this is great, Vic. Thank you so much for having me.
David Margolick has been my guest. The book is Dreadful, The Short Life and Gay Times of John Horne Burns. And I need to mention very quickly that it is very well illustrated. Lots of great photos, some copies of the letters, a lot of really classic shots. And my favorite is the one of Burns from Life magazine just after the war with four other writers as he scowls at the camera.
Yeah, that's right. That is a great picture. And he's front and center in it.
Uh-huh. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. It has been a dozen years since we invaded Afghanistan. But what do we really know about that country and the people who live there? Tune in next week to find out a lot more about Afghanistan when our guest will be Anna Bodkin. Her book is The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. Coming up in the Book Nook, The World is a Carpet. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.